We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging. A belated congratulations to Logie winner Ron Iddles. Ron won a Silver Logie for Most Outstanding Factual or Documentary Program for his Foxtel series, The Good Cop. Our patrons received a celebratory exclusive episode of Australian True Crime this week, which was a live recording of Ron talking about his career as part of our recent season at Chapel Off Chapel in Melbourne. So I hope you all enjoy that. And our newsletter recipients also received a special gift this week. It's a copy of the Ticket Holders Program from CrimeCon 2019, which was recently held in New Orleans. It's really more of a magazine, though, with lots of very interesting articles and profiles. There's a long interview with Skye Borgman, the director of the Netflix documentary Abducted in Plain Sight. Remember that? So weird. So creepy. And there's also a conversation between Laura Richards, the Scotland Yard profiler, I love her so much, and Deborah and Tara Newell, the real-life mother and daughter from Dirty John. So Laura Richards interviews Deborah and Tara. It's really good. This is a great magazine, and they've very kindly given us permission to share it with you as part of our newsletter. You can sign up for the newsletter and find the Patreon link at our website, AustralianTrueCrimePodcast.com, and at our Australian True Crime Facebook page. Thank you to our new patrons, Dave Peters, Penny Palmer, Cece, Brooke O'Connor, Jane, Danielle Burton, Louise Gale, Barton Slattery. That is a good name. You, there should be crime books written about you as the policeman, the detective, not the criminal. Or both. Ooh, both. You could be both. That's a good book. Kate Cockshorn. Yes. Jacinta. Shanna Liv. Shannon Lambden. A Solo. That's wonderful. A Solo. Laura Fraser. Diane Nolan. And this week's favourite name, Erin Punton Morrison. Oh, love that. Okay, on with the show. The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
And then when the serving policeman got angry with Adele, the serving policeman, it is said, it is alleged, perhaps shook her or put the arm around and did what coppers used to do in those wicked old days, and that was to put pressure on the carotid artery and then faint. And it is said by some people very quietly that perhaps that happened, and perhaps poor Adele never came out of the out of her unconscious state. And this would present the senior policeman with quite an embarrassing problem.
This is, without exaggeration, one of the most gripping stories I've ever been told in my life. And it shouldn't come as any surprise, because the storyteller is arguably Australia's greatest true crime storyteller. It's Andrew Rule. Emily and I have made no secret of our fandom of Andrew Rule's work, from his newspaper columns, his books, to now his podcast, Life and Crimes. We finally took the plunge into live events recently, thanks to the encouragement and the enthusiasm of the great people at Chapel Off Chapel in Melbourne. And Andrew was our very first guest. Andrew Rule is so ubiquitous, so authoritative, and such a charming and funny raconteur. It's easy to forget that he's naturally irritated some very scary people over the years. You have to be very brave to do what Andrew Rule does, and today he tells us about one of the most frightening episodes of his career. If you're very lucky, like I was on the night, this will be the first time you've ever heard of the old Tanner family farm in Bonnie Doon. Because if that's the case, you'll be as shocked by the many twists and turns in this story as I was.
And he is here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please make him very welcome, Andrew Rule. And of course, what about my beautiful partner, Emily Webb? Yeah. Oh, this is exciting. We've got Madonna mics. We're very serious about this. Both very big fans and very excited to kick off our first ever live show with you, sir. Tell us about the case that you are going to talk to us about tonight.
I think the Tanner case.
Okay.
The Tanner case is one of those that I broke back in the 90s, and it remains one of the better stories I've done in my career, and possibly the one that caused the most angst, because we always get that question later in the night, do you feel frightened about any of the people you've dealt with or the cases you've done? And this is the one that is a little bit interesting in that respect.
I remember reading that story in the Sunday Age.
You do?
When it came out. I remember there was the photo of Jennifer, beautiful, beautiful young mum in the paper, that famous portrait shot.
It was, yeah.
And I just remember like absolutely lapping that story up.
It was a very interesting story. It was tragic. Jennifer was a young mother with a 21-month-old son. She was in 1984, November, Wednesday night, in Bonnie Doon, which is where it's serene, as you know. The serenity was shattered that night, good and properly, because she was home with her little boy and her husband, Laurie, local farmer. They lived on the farm, the old Tanner family farm, which is relevant. And he was a bit of a shearer, a bit of a truck driver, a bit of a half a no-hoper in some respects, but okay, local guy. He said, I'm going into town to pick up some groceries or whatever. And she said, oh, bring me back, you know, bread and milk and a surprise. And she was quite cheerful, apparently, and quite happy. And when he got home, he finds her on the couch in the living room, dead, bleeding from wounds in her head and actually from the hands. There's, interestingly, a half a cup of coffee near her and some biscuits laid out in a plate, and her little boy is in the cot in the next room. And naturally, look, there was a rifle between her knees, and naturally he thought she'd shot herself. And I actually believe that Laurie believed that she had shot herself at that moment.
So she's married into the Tanner family.
She's married into the Tanner family. Her name was Jennifer Blake.
And she's living on the Tanner farm that his father has established.
At Bonnie Doon, yeah, the old Tanner farm that's been around probably in the family for a century.
Wow. How many people are living on the farm? How many Tanners are living there?
Well, only that couple, but it had been where the Tanner boys grew up. So that was Laurie and his three brothers, the youngest of whom was Dennis, one N.
I shall make a note of that.
We like that in my business. Reporters and detectives, we like to be accurate.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Dennis, who's one N, was the youngest, but possibly the most dominant brother, I feel. You've seen this happen in families?
The baby. Yes, I have.
Yes. Yeah. So you're the baby?
No, why do you say that? No, I'm the eldest, I'm the opposite. Yes.
Right, so am I. And in this case, we're barracking for the eldest, but he wasn't as strong a personality as his brother, Dennis. And the death of Jennifer was quickly disposed of by those who were around, the local police at Mansfield, as a suicide. Now, this was intriguing because the two police who were first called there, they were just old local coppers who were good at pulling up, you know, cars driving up to the snowfields. They weren't investigators. But they go in there and they see this young woman with the rifle and they think, oh, suicide, this is awful. Little boy over in the cot, that's horrible. And they pick up the bolt-action 22 rifle and they open it and there's a spent shell in the breech, as you'd expect, because she's got a bullet hole. And then one of the police finds an empty shell on the floor and he goes, ooh, two spent shells. Why would that be? And then he looks a bit closer and he realises there's a bit of blood on her hands and one thing leads to another. But the key facts are these. The crime scene boss at Mansfield Police Station was a former homicide detective who was an expert at crime scenes. And because he was up in the country now at Mansfield, he was a sergeant. he was experienced, and he was supposed to go to crime scenes, put up the tape, take the photographs, do all that good, you know, forensic stuff. And he wasn't at work on night shift as he was supposed to be. He was supposed to be on night shift. He had signed in and written in the book, or whatever you do, at 7 p.m. But then he'd gone missing. He was working a phantom shift. Mm. As I say, he'd gone visiting someone up towards Mount Buller. But this is where the plot thickens, ladies and gentlemen. And this is the spooky bit that you couldn't make up. And this guy is missing in action. So when he turns up, you know, tired and emotional next day, they're going, where the hell were you, Skipper? Because we needed you out at this, what looks like a crime scene. And suddenly he developed a great interest in promoting Jennifer Tanner's death as a suicide because that would save his ass, I think.
Mm-hmm.
This is my opinion. This might be the bit you cut out. No.
That's fine, yeah.
And that was one of the reasons, one of the lucky breaks that I think her killer had was that particular thing. Now, there's some very intriguing things here. One is Jenny's parents, who never believed that she killed herself, were not told for 1 year that she had two wounds in her forehead and defence wounds in the webbing of her hands, as if she'd put her hands in front of the rifle barrel. Why would they not be told? I don't know. That intrigues me. It was a very well-held secret in the police force and at Mansfield Police Station. And this didn't sit comfortably with this poor old baggy-ass copper Bill Kerr, who was the guy that had found the spent shells at the scene. Now, this guy, he's a good bloke, he's honest, and when I say a baggy-ass country copper, I mean it in a friendly way, because he's a good guy. I'd say that about myself. And I greatly admire Bill Kerr because he, despite being at the bottom of the pecking order in a very tough business, tough profession, where you have a lot of dominating superior officers, he actually, I think, made sure the parents got to know the truth. He taped phone calls that he received from the local pathologist, the pathologist at Shepparton Hospital, a man who sadly had some form of cancer and later died. Mm. This man rang up the police station at Mansfield 2 or 3 or 4 days after Jennifer's death and said, are you sure that this is a suicide? And the sergeant that should have been there and wasn't, he said, oh, yeah, we're pretty sure. It looks like one, doesn't it? And the pathologist says, well, funny you should ask that because it doesn't. She's got two bullets in her brain and she's got these wounds in her hand. I find it hard to believe that that would be consistent with suicide. It's more likely homicide. But then Phipps talks him down and says, now look, doctor, and stands over him and sort of encourages him to switch his thought processes around and says, we're sure it's suicide. Everything indicates it's suicide because we know that it's suicide because she was depressed, which is taking a liberty with the truth, ladies and gentlemen, because there's nothing to indicate she was depressed at all. And he basically bullied and pushed and shoved and connived this poor pathologist into agreeing reluctantly that it might be suicide. And that was used dishonestly, in my belief, at a later inquest the following year to promote the idea that it was a suicide.
That she shot herself once.
That she shot herself.
And
oh, well, no.
Survived?
Survived. Yeah, shot herself and then, you know, oh, shit, I've got a bullet in my brain, but it hasn't quite killed me. A bolt-action rifle, for those who don't know, is like a manual car. You have to lift the bolt and pull the action back, and then you push it forward and down. Now, that's four separate motions. Then she has to reverse. Under the suicide scenario, she has to reverse the rifle, which is a full-length, good rifle, and somehow trigger it with her toe a second time. And hold it in such a way that it shoots through the webbing of her hands. This strikes me as highly unlikely.
And it's very unlikely. Suicide by gunshot for women is not a thing. A thing. Did they think about that?
They didn't want to think about that. Because this is
it's very rare.
When I wrote the story all those years later, which we can get into in a minute, I went and asked experts, and experts said, yeah, in Texas, where nearly everybody shoots, and where mummy and daddy go down to the rifle range and shoot, women are almost as inclined to shoot themselves as men are for suicide. But basically, people who don't use guns, particularly women, tend not to use them for suicide. They tend to use pills or whatever, some other means. And women per se are less inclined to do something that is going to, you know, wreck their looks. It's not as usual. So that's a statistical fact. Jennifer, yes, she lived on a farm, but she was a town girl originally. She had been shown how to use the rifle by her husband, but had never sort of been shooting or anything. She did know how to use it. So it's conceivable that she could kill herself with a rifle, but highly unlikely. And there was no suggestion, really, and I know this from the family doctor, who was later my doctor. Can you believe that? The family doctor from Benalla later moved to Melbourne, and he was my doctor, and we used to talk about this. And he was a very frank doctor, unlike most. And he said to me, it stunk to high heaven. There was nothing. He said she had a lot going on with the Tanner brothers because they're no good, but there was nothing to suggest that she was suicidal.
That's just how the doctor got you to pay for half an hour instead of 15 minutes.
That's right. His name was Dr. Patience.
Oh.
That's true.
Is the husband going along, Laurie? Is Laurie always just going, oh, okay, if you reckon? Or is he at any point going, what?
That's a very interesting question.
She was fine when I went out for milk.
Yeah.
Like, what is Laurie saying?
I believe that Laurie was truly shocked and surprised. And even though there has been a sneaky undercurrent of suggestions in recent years to point the finger at Laurie over this and to say that perhaps others covered up for Laurie, I doubt it, personally. And I'm not saying Laurie's a great bloke or hasn't got his full suite of vices and problems. He might have, like most of us. But I don't believe he killed his wife. I think he was very shocked. And I say that because the night before we published the story in the paper I then worked for, the Sunday paper I then worked for, which shall remain nameless because I no longer work for it, it's no longer the paper it was.
It's dead to us. Yeah, sure.
It's dead to us.
Yep.
You know, Laurie was very shocked when I rang him and said, tomorrow we're going to run this story saying this, this and this. He stumbled, he stuttered. He was saying, what are you telling me? Can you say that again? I'm at a cattle sale. Can I just walk around the corner out of the wind? And he was totally shocked and distressed, as opposed to sullen and silent. There's a difference. And he was stuttering like a child. He was almost in tears, I would think. And I explained it. I said, Laurie, do me a favour. I said, this is now 12 years later. Your wife was found shot at your house, and she's got two bullet holes in her head. And he goes, what? I said, she's got two bullet holes in her head, in her brain, and she's got wounds in her hands. He said, what? I said, I explained it. And he said, I didn't know that. Oh. Now, you know what? I don't think he did. I think Laurie was in shock at the time. I think he was herded away from all but his own appearance at the first very small quiet inquest held in a church hall in Mansfield in 1986. I don't think the details of the case were ever reported by anybody much. And it was all kept under wraps so much that poor, silly Laurie didn't know until I rang him 12 years later the full details of his wife's death. Either that or he is a far better actor than I believe he is.
How did that feel for you? Because that...
I was stunned.
To me, it would be quite shocking and sickening almost.
I was stunned, and then I rang his brother Dennis.
With one N.
One N. And Dennis, in contrast to his brother, his big brother, was very, very sulky and very, very silent. And he heard me out for some minutes, and then he said that he was obviously waiting for me to come out with the killer evidence or something. And when he thought he was safe, he said, yeah, that's not worth a hatful of monkey's assholes. That's what he said. I wouldn't make that up.
No, you would not.
And he, having said that, he basically hung up, but he was very anxious to hear everything that I had to say about what was going to be published, and he was very anxious not to say anything that could be used, and his demeanour was entirely different from his brother's, shall we say.
Wow. Who raised the son who was in the house when Jenny was murdered? Or, beg your pardon, when Jenny died.
When Jenny died violently. She was shot to death, the coroner said. Later. Look, he was basically raised in that first dozen years by his paternal grandmother and grandparents, the Tanners. But he had access to his mother's people, the Blakes, who I was friendly with, Les and Kath Blake. And when I went to see the Blakes, when I wrote the story in 96, and the reasons we'll go into it in a minute, I spoke to them, and Mrs. Blake was a small, feisty, tough woman, and she said, "My daughter, gee, I knew it. I'm so pleased you've turned up, because my daughter didn't kill herself, and I'll tell you why. You know, she was planning Christmas. She'd ordered all these presents for everybody. She'd ordered a new lounge suite on time payment, and so on and so on. She had all these reasons why Jennifer was planning for the future, and Jennifer was quite content, or content enough, etc., etc. And Jennifer's father, Les Blake, who was a large, good-looking, lovely man, a very nice man who'd worked in the timber industry all his life, he wasn't as feisty. He was a quieter chap. And he said, "This is good and this is all very well, but will it mean we lose our grandson?" Mm. And I said, "Les, I can't tell you that. If we run the story, which we're going to, I don't know what the effect will be, and I hope it doesn't cost you your contact with your grandson." And I'm afraid to say it probably did. It probably did. So there's one of the things we have to live with.
After the break, the many stunning twists and turns of the Tanner case begin to reveal themselves. Coming up on Australian True Crime, a long-lost woman, some thought of as completely disposable, comes back to turn things upside down. But first, Emily wants to know more about how Andrew came upon the story. And that's a story in and of itself.
I want to know, you know, when you just hear something and you just roll with it as a journalist. I want to know, where was the seed for this? Because I love hearing about that. Yes.
Okay. It's 1996. Back in 95, there's been a smallish story saying bones found in mineshaft at Bonnie Doon, up at there. Now, this was not a very big story. It turned out that the bones were subsequently identified as a transsexual prostitute called Adele Bailey, who'd gone missing from St Kilda back in 1978, which is, you know, a dozen years, many years earlier. And that story was intriguing, and especially intriguing to us in the business, but not huge. But then one day in 96, this is less than a year after the discovery of the bones in the mine shaft, I'm at work at the paper where I then worked, which was a broadsheet newspaper. Remember, they're the big ones. It was quite a good paper at the time. And I'm contacted by a fellow who's in the homicide squad, and I know this fellow.
Do we know this fellow?
No. And I... it's a sad story what happened to him later on because of other things, because the exposure to dead children and things, it's not good for you. But anyway, this fellow said to me, "I want to meet you and have a chat. Where will we go?" And I said, "I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll meet at the Age Canteen." There, the name came out. Because
never heard of it.
There's one thing at the Age Canteen. I can get you in there, but there will be no other coppers there. So he said, "Good idea." So we go there. And he tells me this story. He says, "Look," he goes back a year to 1995 to the mine shaft at Bonnie Doon, and let's sketch in the story here for all you people. In 1995, two young men who know Bonnie Doon really well. They didn't actually live there, but they used to holiday there all the time, and they knew it well. And they used to go hunting rabbits and all that sort of stuff. And they go up this big bridge, which is right out the back of the old Tanner farm. And they know that there's a mine shaft. Now, this mine shaft's on top of a ridge, and it's about as big as that table. I'm moving very slowly, so I don't hit that mic. And it's a very small hole on top of a very lonely ridge. And they have got a rope and a torch. And these two young fellows, being intrepid and being young and probably stupid, they tie a rope to a tree about as thick as my arm, and they let themselves down the mine shaft. Now, the mine shaft is actually fairly shallow, and it goes down like that, and then it turns and goes sideways, like a footy sock, right? A footy sock with a very big foot. And they get down, you know, it goes down several metres, and then they hit the bottom, the heel of the sock, and they look along the drive, as it's called, laterally, and with a torch, and they see some things, and they crawl along, and they go, that's interesting, there's a watch, and there's a bangle, and there's this and that, and there's two old silicon things that don't know what they are, and there's a pair of very faded knickers, and different stuff, and some bones. And they take the biggest bone, I think it might have been this one, maybe, and they carry the bone up to the surface with their torch and their rope, and they go, this looks a bit sus. So they go down to the doctor that's in Bonnie Doon, and they said, look, Doc, what we found. He said, where'd you get that? In the mine shaft. I said, well, that's very interesting because that's a human bone. And he rings the Wallopers, and the Wallopers have a look, and the Wallopers ring the Homicide Squad. And the Homicide Squad comes up with possibly the search and rescue guys, and they land at Bonnie Doon. And they go down the mine shaft and they bring out one bone after another. They bring out the knickers, they bring out the silicon stuff, they bring out the watch, they bring out all this stuff. And they do all the police stuff and they carefully label it. And there you have essentially a skeleton, albeit knocked about, because, you know, animals have got down there and all the rest of it. And it's been thrown down there with some force probably, so it's not good. And that is the skeleton which is later identified as Adele Bailey. Now, Adele Bailey was a Pitcairn Islander by origin, or, you know, by her parents were, or grandparents. And a lot of the Pitcairn people, you know, they're the ones that came off the descendants of the Mutiny
Bounty,
on the Mountain.
Yeah.
You know, Fletcher Christian, etc. They had moved, as we know, from Pitcairn Island, many of them, to Norfolk Island, and then many of them moved from there to New Zealand. Both Adele and her cousin came to Australia, made some money in the sex industry, and then went to Cairo and had sex changes and came back and worked the streets of St Kilda. And that was where poor old Adele met her end, because in St Kilda, and this is where we have to join the dots, and this is where you have to be careful. This is about legalities, okay? This will get you sued.
Okay.
Adele was quite possibly arrested or picked up or told to get in a police car or something. And Adele was probably, this is a reconstruction of likely events from people who have nodded and winked at me, right? So this is, I can't prove this, but I believe it to be true. Adele was coerced into some sort of sex act with a serving policeman, who was a reasonably senior serving policeman. And then when the serving policeman got angry with Adele, having discovered that Adele had not been born a female, the serving policeman, it is said, it is alleged, the serving policeman was angry and perhaps shook her or put the arm around and did what coppers used to do in those wicked old days, and that was to put pressure on the carotid artery. So people would do the chicken, they would do that one, and then faint. And it is said by some people very quietly that perhaps that happened, and perhaps poor Adele never came out of the out of her unconscious state. And this would present the senior policeman with quite an embarrassing problem in his car or his cell or something, somewhere where it was embarrassing.
I never knew any of that, but I remember the photograph so clearly of Adele, and for some reason I always really felt a deep sorrow for her. I don't.
Yes.
Yeah, there was something about the photo that that made me just really, as soon as you mentioned her name, I thought, I remember Adele Bailey.
Tragic stuff.
Yeah.
And Narelle's spoken about how sex workers were treated in St Kilda back then. Yeah. She was a young copper in the early 80s and she said how they were treated by,
and plus, am I the only person in the room who didn't know about the chicken? I did not
know
that was a thing.
That in.
Yeah,
that
no, I loved it. Thank you. I've learnt that.
I'm told it was a thing by a detective who I met in a hotel about this, and he spoke very quietly in case I was taping him, and he sort of went, he sort of did.
So he should.
Sign
so he bloody should. Yes.
And he nodded and whispered. And this is how I got that version. But a story that I've heard versions of from several sources, and it makes sense.
Yeah.
Because we know that Adele from New Zealand did not, in her high heels and her tight skirt and all that, get herself to Bonnie Doon, walk up several kilometres into the hills where there are nothing but rabbits and kangaroos and a few old merino sheep, and then put herself down a mine shaft. That didn't happen. I think Adele was dead. And Adele was taken there by one of the very few people in the world on Earth who knows where that mine shaft is. And that would include people who grew up in the area. And that mine shaft, ladies and gentlemen, as I say, is about that size. It is reasonably obscure, and it is just over the back fence of the old Tanner farm. It is over the back fence, and it's where the Tanners and other locals, when they shot, you know, they had dead sheep, they would throw them down there, or when they shot kangaroos and whatever, they threw them down there, all that sort of stuff. It was a place where you threw stuff, as happens on farms where there's a pit, rubbish gets thrown into it and whatever. Now, it strikes me as highly likely that a friendly police person would do a favour for his a boss that he was friendly with and get rid of a body. That's how it strikes me.
A friend with one N.
Friend does have one N.
It does.
It's a silent P, as in swimming, as my grandfather did.
What?
My grandfather used to say. He learnt that in World War I.
So this conversation is happening in 96.
This conversation's happening in 96. We're talking about the 95 discovery.
Your mate's saying, oi, remember that thing that happened in 95?
And he says, so that's all the background to bring us all up to speed. So then my homicide squad mate says, I've got a friend in the homicide squad who shares a name with me, actually, first name. And he happened to be in the crew that was the homicide crew that was sent to Bonnie Doon that day last year. And the crew could have been anybody. See, they have a sergeant and two detectives, right? And you have an on-call crew. Now, it so happened that on that day, the on-call crew sent to Bonnie Doon included this guy. And this guy was a young copper who was a first cousin of Jennifer Tanner. Do you like that?
I love that.
It is said by at least his aunt, Kath Blake, that she thinks he joined the police force because he was always worried about what happened to his cousin, and the whole family didn't believe she was really suicided and so on. Now, whether that's true, I don't know, but it was his first cousin. He was a young detective without a lot of clout, but he did have a lot of worries about the whole thing. And when Adele Bailey's bones are brought out and identified, he goes, this is interesting. We have here bones brought out of a mine shaft behind the old Tanner farm. And if you look down at the farmhouse, that's where my cousin was found shot to death years before. Is this a bit of a coincidence that these two violent deaths in the same district, almost on the same property, in the same era? And he came to the conclusion, perhaps, it's not something he talks about much, but I believe he came to the conclusion that it was something was rotten in the state of Denmark, or at least at Bonnie Doon. And he told his friend, but he didn't know what to do about it, because he decided after several months, nearly a year, that the investigation was getting nowhere, that this link that he could see wasn't gaining traction. And he didn't really know what to do about it. One day, one night, according to my friend, got his daughter's little daughter's push bike, and he rode on the footpath in the cover of darkness, which is illegal, Michelle, because he didn't have a helmet or a light. And he drove around to in a Bayside suburb to the other detective's house, and he said, come out in the backyard, because they're all paranoid. They all think these bugs in the light and all that. And he's told him the sad story and said, look, I don't think they're trying. Someone somewhere is not trying, because nothing's happening with this. And I reckon it stinks and so on and so forth. So what will we do? And my guy says, I'm going to go and talk to this journo. And that's how I came to be put in the picture. And those guys obtained for me the 1985 inquest brief from the first inquest, the one in the church hall that no one knew about.
Would have been quite flimsy, was it?
No, not well, no? Interesting. It was flimsy in some respects, but there was some very interesting material in it. Just because Laurie didn't know it was there didn't mean it wasn't there. And the interesting thing about that first inquest is the coroner, who was not the first coroner to be approached to be the coroner in that case, someone else, a local magistrate, had knocked back the job on the grounds that he didn't want to sit on a case, quote unquote, he's dead now, this bloke, quote unquote, where that copper shot his sister-in-law.
Oh, wow.
He didn't want to sit on that. So this nice Melbourne coroner magistrate did it. And that man, bless his cotton socks, listened to all this heavily slanted evidence and this one-sided stuff. And then he wrote a finding which said that despite the police evidence being heavily slanted towards a finding of suicide, that he would not make that finding, and he made it an open finding. Mm. Now, this was a very good thing that he did, because it left it open, literally left it open to be picked up. And it was never really, no one was home and hosed while that was an open case.
Hey, could it hypothetically be considered corruption for a police officer to take this information and hand it to a journalist?
Those chaps, they took the old brief, which is really public property, I think. There's no reason why technically I couldn't get that brief from somewhere, but the reality is it's a bit harder than it looks. So it always is, you know.
Yeah.
Technically you're allowed it, but yeah. Anyway, they pulled the one off the shelf at the homicide office, gave it to me, and I threw it through a car window at me. And I hit me on the chest. It was like Dustin Martin. And I'm straight up. He plays for Richmond. That's an AFL. And I photocopied it instantly on the thing where it did, you know, 193 pages.
And, the stat, whatever it's called.
No, it wasn't that. No, it was a real photocopy.
Right, sorry. The Canon. Yeah, I'm imagining this is happening in 1971. Yeah. But so it's not illegal, but it would have been frowned upon.
So I copied it all, and then I had my own set, and I gave them back theirs, and I threw it back through the window of the car, and I went back to the homicide and went back on the shelf.
Okay.
So then I had this set. So I start reading it, and it's just an open book. It goes, here's Mr. Dyke, the pathologist, 2 bullet wounds. Mm-hmm. I go, what? Another one, here's this, here's that. Here's Bill Kerr, the old copper. And I just sit there and ring all these people. So Dyke's, I think, dead by this, but I ring his assistant, Mr. Dr. Sonnenberg. I remember these names, amazing. Can't remember what I had for breakfast.
Yeah.
Sonnenberg says, yeah, well, it was a bit of a worry, you know, we were never that happy with that. Anyway, the coppers seemed to think it was suicide. I've rung Kath Blake. Here's the thing. She acted. Now, I've run her out of the blue. She answers the phone at Mansfield, and you'd think she'd been waiting.
Yeah.
She knew that I was going to ring 5 minutes earlier.
Yeah.
It's as if she'd been waiting all those years for me to ring. She said, yes, right, well, I'll tell you. You come up and see me because my daughter didn't commit suicide. And here's why, those reasons I outlined earlier. Mm. And she had a lot of reasons, partly, I think, her strong Catholic faith, which is against suicide, which Jennifer probably shared. That was one reason of many. There were a lot of reasons. And they were good reasons. And I then ring Bill Kerr, who's by this stage, this is the
The good copper.
The good copper.
The saggy ass copper that you mean in a nice way.
The good copper.
Yeah.
It must have gnawed at him for years.
Yes.
Imagine that feeling.
Imagine
thinking,
that feeling.
This is dodgy.
So Bill Kerr, interestingly, has gone as far away from Mansfield as he's left the job, left the police force. He's gone to Hamilton, the other end of Victoria, about as far as you can get from Mansfield. And he's a parking officer down there for the council. Mm. And he lives out on a property with his wife and he lives a quiet life. And he said, I'll see you. He said, where do you live? And at the time I lived just out of Melbourne. And he said, I'm going up to Eildon next Thursday to see somebody. I'll come and see you. So he came to my house with his wife and we sat down, had the cup of tea, and he talked to me and talked to me and talked to me. And it was as if he had been waiting 12 years to unburden himself. Mm. He said, and he said a lot, but you could sum it up in one sentence. He said, son, I've never worked out how you could shoot yourself twice in the head and in the hands with a bolt action rifle. It's just, and when we filmed this later for a documentary, he went and grabbed his own rifle and demonstrated it to the camera. He was red hot on it. And I think he was right. It was just highly unlikely. I found, a man that was a pathologist and super duper doctor who'd worked in Rhodesia, as it was in the old days, Zimbabwe. In Africa, and he'd treated 200 gunshot wounds, victims and dead people and all the rest of it. He was an expert on gunshot wounds of the type we don't have in Australia because they don't see many of them. And he went through it all with me and said, look, I think those wounds of, the first one would have disabled her, even if she wasn't technically dead. I think it's highly unlikely. So by the time I'd worked my way through the brief and then skirted around and got bits and pieces, I really had the story. It was largely in the brief.
So what happened when this story landed?
Well, the first thing that happened when I started to make noises was the police force took out a writ. Took out an injunction,
they
I'm sorry.
They did
an
not.
Injunction. They injuncted it. And that actually made me a little bit happy after a while because I thought, well, that means no one can publish it. They injuncted the whole thing. So that meant, and we injuncted it until a Sunday, and I was working for a Sunday
paper. Because we forget that. So your journalist ego is also terrified that someone else is going to get this story first.
It's for living.
They're going to get it out first.
Now, the injunction ended up being a bit of a blessing, and they said, we're still investigating this. You're getting in our way. You're interfering. You could be warning people that need to be investigated. And it seemed that everywhere they went there rapidly, I'd just been. They were busy basically doing what I was doing and playing catch-up because they had not been doing it.
Yep.
It had been at the bottom of the pile and had been left at the bottom of the pile, and suddenly in a fortnight they were going to do it all because it was all going to be very smelly. And in the end, we had out 2 weeks or whatever, and we published the story. And the story was very good in the first edition of the paper. You know the one that's printed early?
Yeah.
It was very good in that paper. It was a big front page story.
It was.
A beautiful story. But you know what happened that night, ladies and gentlemen?
What?
Some idiot at the AFL park at the football lit a toilet roll in the toilets with a cigarette lighter. Now, this was a very short-lived. It wasn't even a fire. It was just a toilet roll on fire. But for some brain-dead football reporter, he thought they were going to burn the stadium down. He thought it was, the LA riots. He thought it was Paris burning. And the people back at the desk at the paper, one of whom, they're very capable people, and I'm very friendly with them, but if you work late at night on a newspaper, you are always vulnerable to the thought that there's a big story breaking that you're going to get and beat the opposition. And that night, for about 20 minutes, they thought, this is it. We've got AFL Park burning down. And they pulled my story off the front and pushed it to inside and ran this crap story that was out of date before the bloody thing hit the printer. Before it was on the printing press, there was no fire. It was crap. And that pushed a real story inside. There's a lesson here. Never push a real story out of the way.
Okay. With a fake one. So that's what happened to your front page. But I was actually asking more about what happened to the case. Well,
but it is relevant.
Okay,
because
good.
It shows why, because the second edition is the one that everybody reads.
Really? Hang on. What time does the first edition come out?
The first edition goes to the country.
Right.
And next day, you know what I realised? Oh. I'm in the country. I'm living in the country.
Right.
And I'm driving to Bendigo to see Mother's Day or whatever it was, so my mother's birthday. And I turn the radio on and the opening, the bulletin of the radio, it doesn't lead on the Tanaka.
It's the bloody dunny roll.
Said, as soon as I said, no, it's not the dunny roll.
No.
But it's not the Tanaka. And I said, I know what's happened. In the city, in the second edition, the one everybody's reading, this story's been bumped.
Right.
And I tweaked because my edition at home in the country was all over the front.
Mm.
But I tweaked straight away because it wasn't leading the radio news. So they actually butchered a really big story and lost its momentum in some respects.
Yeah. But I'm sure that the Tanner family was all over it. So, you know, what...
They got the first edition.
I'm sure they did. And I'm sure their lawyers did. And I'm sure what was the upshot of all of this?
The story really pushed, and the subsequent stories, which it did.
Yeah.
Pushed it so that in the end the authorities and the police have to sort of get on board and have a shot.
Yeah. Like
they quashed the old original inquest finding. They call a new inquest, which started in 96 sometime and ran over 23 sitting days over about a year under the coroner, Graham Johnson, who was a very quiet and intelligent, judicious man, who didn't indulge in the sort of chatty, funny stuff with the barristers at the bar table. He was kept his own distance. And he happened to be, which is good for a magistrate or a judge or anybody or a coroner, he happened to be a recreational shooter. He was a pistol shooter and went to target places. And
knew his guns.
And he knew his guns. And he knew what he was listening to. And what he wasn't listening to, which is not always the case with the bench, Michelle, because sometimes these people, intelligent as they are really thick and they do dumb shit.
Yeah.
Let me go through a few of those. No. Judges can get it wrong. Coroners can get it wrong. Magistrates can get it wrong because they're only human. But Graham Johnson didn't, and he knew what he was looking at. And he made a very brave finding, and a finding that others have seen fit to pick at since with increasing frequency, but that doesn't make them right. And he found that Jennifer Tanner had been shot to death by her brother-in-law, Dennis Tanner. With one end. Sergeant Dennis Tanner, a serving policeman.
Is he? You never mentioned that.
Serving policeman.
Dennis Tanner's a serving policeman.
He was.
At the time of her death.
Back in the day, he was in St Kilda in South Melbourne.
And right at the
epicentre of... Sorry, I thought you'd know that.
Nuh-uh.
Most of the audience doesn't.
They did not. No, we didn't. You did.
Oh, go with me.
No, but it was great the way you dropped it then. That was amazing. It blew my mind. Wow. Yeah.
So there.
Did they ever give a reason, though? Why would someone want to kill Jennifer?
Well, my catch-all answer to such questions, and it's a fair question and one everybody wants to ask, it's the dinner party question, really, and you're entitled to ask it. And that is, murders are, or violent killings, manslaughters, whatever, homicides, are rarely totally logical crimes. They are often very stupid crimes. It is not that stupid for me to want to rob the Commonwealth Bank of 20 million because if I get away with it, I've got 20 million.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not that smart for me to go home, argue with my better half about burning the fish and kick her to death, which does happen in some circles. And I know, you know, every homicide copper will tell you that's what most homicides are.
Mm.
It's an argument over something. And it can be over money, it can be over the fish, it can be over, God knows, you know, running the car into a tree, whatever. Most murders and homicides are dumb crimes. And I believe that in this instance, we know for a fact that Laurie Tanner had been married before.
Okay.
And Laurie Tanner had been married to a woman called Suzanne, who was a school teacher that he'd met at Mansfield. And she'd gone to live with him on the old Tanner farm in the same farmhouse. And guess what? She wasn't really up for it. And after a while, she said, Laurie, I'm going my own sweet way. I think I'll go back to Fitzroy. That's an inner suburb of Melbourne. Just, we with it?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. And I will have exit. And this is in the 70s, so scale the money to, you know, a time when I earned $3,000 a year, I think Mrs. Laurie Tanner wanted 20.
Whoa,
so
wow.
It was a proper amount of money. And I understand that, and I spoke to Suzanne about this, I understand that the Tanner family scrimped and saved and borrowed and put together the sum to pay her out so they could keep the old family farm, because people do get very attached to family farms. Mm. It's not just another property.
Mm.
It's not a block of flats. It's the family farm, and it's your granddad, you know, cleared it, and that means something to you. So I reckon, because Laurie wasn't the sort of guy that whose wives would not want to leave him, probably, that Dennis, he allegedly said to a hotel broker, he allegedly said these words, we paid out the first slut, but I made sure the second slut didn't have to get paid, or words to that effect. Every which way, I know there's a lot of things we haven't said here, but every which way you look at it, it adds up to a homicide. And you will hear people posit alternative theories. And in fact, Dennis Tanner and a complete idiot called Ron Irwin, who
we
was
were
just,
speaking about this before, weren't we?
Who was always a dill, he's now a dead dill. he wrote this lickspittle, pathetic, rubbishy book 16 or 17 years after the event with Dennis Tanner, which affects all those years afterwards, which was called Blackened Tanner. Good play on words, hey? And
the Dennis Tanner story, I believe. The strapline was.
The strapline. And essentially that was a sort of a lame lawyer's defence case. In other words, it picked up all sorts of bits and pieces of strange exotica and allegations and nonsense and made-up stuff and half-true things, and a farrago of facts and fiction and downright lies.
Like an alibi, and, alleged alibi.
Yes, 17 years later.
Dennis wasn't
I was booking
was in Melbourne or something.
An English tourist who was driving a combi van. I remember now he had parked near the boulevard in St Kilda. It's just come back to me 2 decades later.
Yeah.
That was it. Yeah, it was good. It was really good.
Is he still alive, by the way, Dennis with one
end? Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Because now I'm just remembering.
He's taking snapshots of us now, and he could run you off the road.
Shush! No. Don't, because I remember now.
Maybe you could cut that bit out.
At the start of this conversation, you said, people always ask me what are the scariest cases I've written about, and this is one of them.
It's one of them.
Are you scared of Dennis with one end?
I don't know that we need to go down that path, but I'll tell you a story. When I was writing this...
I'll cut this out if you're scared of him. There's no shame in that.
Well, if you met him...
Yeah, no, I'm honest. There's no shame in that. He sounds like a scary dude.
Yes, I understand him. I'll cut it out. Because I came from the bush, from a farm, from similar circumstances, so I get him totally. I understand him in ways that perhaps others don't. And I understand, you know, he's grown up shooting stuff and all that. A man of action.
Clearly.
When I was writing this story, we lived partly in a small house in a quiet suburb of Melbourne, and a lot of the work was done there, and I used to pull the blinds because I was, at the time, I thought there's great pressure on this. They know I'm doing this. And there was a time where I thought it was vulnerable, or I was vulnerable. And I used to pull the blinds. I said to the kids, you know, my wife, don't answer the door at night in case blah, blah. And one night I'd been to a function rather like this where I was speaking at something, and I drove home late and I parked in the street outside our house, our then house, and which we no longer have. And I walked inside as usual, but it's probably midnight, and go inside, clean my teeth, you know, 3 minute shower, jump into bed, right? So it's very quick. Flick the light out. Straight away, I hear this crash outside, big crash.
noise, smashing noise. I go, shit. That's what I said. And I ran out because I've got little kids. I wasn't going to say the other
word.
So you might say the other word.
I would, for
you
sure.
You would, I know. Because you're different. Yeah, I'm a different generation. So I go outside and I've got a torch and I go to my then lovely newish Land Rover, and of which I was very fond, and its windscreen's completely caved in.
No.
And I go, ooh. And I look at inside the Land Rover through the broken glass, and there on the passenger seat are not one but two roof tiles. Now, these were the ridge tiles. They're the ones on top of the roof. There's two of them. And they're big, heavy things. And they're shiny and brand new. And I thought, that's funny. I reckon some guy's coming from the Harp Hotel up in Kew, some tradie, he's pissed, and he's come around the corner and he's off down the quiet streets to stay off the main road. Maybe he's come around the corner a bit quick and these have fallen off the load and hit my car, which was sort of faintly ridiculous because they'd gone straight through the windscreen. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping. I'm looking for the normal excuse. So then I think, no, kids, bad kids. But it was a sort of a weeknight. It wasn't Saturday night and there were no, you know, it just didn't gel. Anyway, I took the tiles, which is probably a good thing, and I took them inside and I put them down. And I wasn't that stressed about this at that stage. And I went to bed and I got up next morning and then I had a good look at them. And I held them up in the light and they're brand new and they're shiny because they've been through the machine and they got the glaze on them. And stamped on them is the date and the time when they're made, exact time, 11:07 or whatever. And I ring Monier because they'd made them. And I said, Mr. Monier, blah, 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 explain myself. I need to know if you can identify these tiles and where they come from, which batch they went out to. And they said, yeah, and they rang me back. And they said, they come from number 36 Birdwood Avenue, Baldwin. Mm. Now, this was interesting because I drove immediately to that address. This was 1.5 kilometres from my house. Too far to walk if you're going to carry. You'd walk your Labrador there, but you wouldn't walk that distance carrying these two roof tiles because they're very heavy. And I saw on the footpath a whole pack of tiles dumped by the truck, as they do, with a crane. And there'd been a kitchen fire at this house and they were redoing the roof. And somebody has been around there. They've pinched these two tiles and then they've driven them, obviously, this is deduction, driven them to my house. And then they've waited for me to come home and park my car. And I thought, oh, this is not good. This is a message. We know where you live. We know what car you drive. And we know when you get home.
What did Mrs. Rule think of this?
She wasn't delighted. We're still married.
Oh, my God.
She's still married. But there's a whole other there's stories she could tell. She was sitting in a doctor's waiting room once and in came, guess who? Two tenor brothers.
Oh, my God.
And she was sure they recognised her. And then later that night the power went off at home. When I wasn't home, she thought somebody had flicked the switch box, which is what bad people do when they're going to do the run-through of your house. They turn off the power at the main and then they run through your house.
Oh.
If it happens, it's only a fluke. And if indeed, in that case, it was. The whole street was out and it wasn't anything bad. But it happened that very night that she'd got a bit of a fright. So there you go. So that was something that happened. And I believe that the people that did that, there were two of them, I think a driver and a tile stealer.
Thrower.
And I believe that it was someone closely connected to the case I had just written about.
So what happened? So Dennis Tanner is named in this inquest, which is not great for him, obviously.
No.
But he's never charged.
No.
So
the inquest is, as a lot of people here will probably suspect, an inquest into a death or a fire is an inquisitorial, hence the name, process whereby the coroner has the power to ask people questions on pain of and say, you've got to answer me unless you put your hand up and say, I could be incriminating myself is the phrase.
Yeah. Or unless they can't find you. That's what I've learned as well. Yeah. I mean, if they can't find you.
They can't find you.
Yeah.
You. And it has to be, in a coronial inquest, the standard of proof is merely on the balance of probability, that is 51%. Whereas in a trial for murder or any other criminal case, it has to be beyond reasonable doubt, which of course is, you know, 9 out of 10, whatever. So that's the difference. And that's why no one was ever charged, because in the end, they were never going to get a conviction.
But also the coroner just makes recommendations, right?
Does.
So really then it's up to the government
true.
Or whoever to take them up or not.
True.
And they usually don't.
True, but in this case, the coroner knew as well as anyone else that it wasn't going to fly.
Yeah.
It's still very powerful to
But it's a power, but he did what he could.
Yeah.
He did what he could.
Nicole Oakes? Nicole here, sing out if you are. Is that you, my love? That's
Hi,
you.
Nicole.
Hello, thank you so much. It's one of these ladies pointing at each other.
Yeah,
it's hard to know.
Hard to see.
What's your favourite international true crime case, Andrew?
Well, internationally, of course, like most of you, we've all heard of, you know, Lord Lucan disappearing. We've, in more recent years, a thing that obsesses a lot of people, I think, is Maddie McCann.
Yes. Oh, my God, I know.
And I think, you know, naturally you can't ignore that. But I've also been intrigued by the brilliant writing about true crime cases, and probably the thing that's been the biggest influence on my career and the way I write stories and the sort of stories I write was In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. And I think that that written in the 60s was the first of that sort of book, and it was brilliant and beautifully written. And it inspired, I believe, an English book called Beyond Belief. I believe it inspired it, which was almost a contemporary, and it's about the Moores murders, Myra Hindley and Ian Brady. And that is also a brilliant book, a very different book, written by a Welsh playwright called Emlyn Williams. And that I found very inspiring. Those two books, I found them riveting. I read them when I was very young, and I've never forgotten them, and I've reread them. And they've stuck with me.
Christy Grant, at any stage in your career were you asked to look into the cold case of Mandy Lee Yodgy in the 1980s?
I'm sad to say, Christy, for some reason I never actually worked on that case to any great extent, but I do know a little bit about it. Mandy Lee Yodgy was a young woman. She disappeared in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne. Two boys found her body one lunchtime lying on an embankment covered in scrub up just off the mountain highway in the Dandenongs in the hills. That was in 1984. The body had been there for several weeks at that time. A post-mortem found no cause of death, but police believe she might have been poisoned. There, obviously no broken neck, no bullet wound, none of that obvious trauma, blunt trauma, and they could never really work it out. That was obviously 30-plus years ago, but the uncertainty sort of lingers on, and I know that Mandy's sister, Marnie Dean, has spoken over the years. Marnie was a child then, 10, I think. She's now, you know, a middle-aged woman who's still haunted by the disappearance of her big sister. And it is one of those sort of little-known cold cases that are very haunting, particularly for those that had anything to do with the girl who vanished.
We could do a podcast episode on that one.
I think you could.
Really good idea, actually. Lily Sabo. Is Lily here? Hi, Lil.
Hi, Lily.
Thank you so much for coming. Why do so many of us love a good true crime story, Andrew?
I think as humans, we're all intrigued by life and death.
Mm.
And from the earliest age, it gets us in. And that leads us to be interested in crime and punishment, in right and wrong, in all those things. And when you think about it, all the great drama that we've, you know, known through history and also contemporary, Shakespeare, what is it? It's life and death. Mm. It's mostly crime stories of one sort or another. And so is opera, so is ballet, so is nearly everything, to some extent, is a version of a crime story.
Well, this takes me to the next question, actually. This is, I've realised recently, one of my favourite elements of true crime stories, Shona's question. Shona here. It's, hey, Shona. Shona's question is, what was the single best, I hope everyone doesn't mind me shortening their names. It's just, sorry, it's just the way I live. Shona says, what was the single best piece of evidence that was key to solving a crime that you can remember? And I just, when I read and hear about investigations, I'm always so dazzled by investigators' minds and the way they figure this out.
probably everyone here, including you two, have got better examples than this, but I'll do this one close to home.
Yep.
The first book I ever wrote was called Cuckoo, and it's about what was a massively big deal case when I was a child, when I was a little boy of about 9 or 10 in the 1960s. There were two big crimes in a matter of weeks. One was the Beaumont children, and the next one in Victoria was the disappearance of two teenagers from Shepparton. They were called Abina Medill and Gary Haywood. She was 16, he was 18. They went missing from a rock dance in Shepparton on the same week that decimal currency was brought in. And they vanished off the face of the earth. It was a massive case because, you know, it was sex and drugs and rock and roll. Well, no drugs probably. But their bodies weren't found for a couple of weeks, maybe 16 days, something like that. And in that time, decimal currency had arrived, but Australia had sort of lost its innocence. And that case was intriguing to me as a child because it was front page news. It was really scary. It was big deal. It was creepy. It was set in the country and yet it intrigued city people. It was sort of the end of an era in Australia. And 19 years later, that case was solved because a brilliant fingerprint guy matched up a fingerprint that had come to his notice routinely because a man, a dirty, you know, ordinary sex offender had been seen exposing himself in Albury, New South Wales, just over the river in Albury, New South Wales, not in Wodonga. And in New South Wales, the fingerprint laws in 1985 were that if you got arrested for anything, they fingerprinted you. So the lady in the shop sees this guy exposing himself. She rings the local coppers. They come down, they grab this bloke, they take him to the cop shop and they get his hands and they put them on the ink and they put them on the paper and they send the thing to Central Fingerprint Bureau, and eventually it gets disseminated over some days and weeks to everywhere. And a genius young fingerprint bloke in Melbourne called Andrew Wall, who wasn't even in Australia back when the Medill Haywood thing happened in 66. He was a kid in England. He says, hang on, that print reminds me of one of these 10 most wanted prints we got here. And he managed to recognise that bit of a hand that had been found on Gary Haywood's F.J. Holden in 1966. Ooh. He managed to, he remembered it because he's got a mind like a steel trap.
Yeah.
And he made that match, and I thought that was a great piece of detection. And it's close to home for me because it was sort of the basis of my first book, which is still with us. I have a version of it out in the foyer.
Do you?
Very good.
Unreal, because I've tried to buy that. I couldn't find a copy anywhere, so I'll buy it tonight.
It's inside an omnibus.
Ah, great.
Which is called something else.
Adele Gleisner. Oh, yeah, is it Adele Gleisner? Is that how I say it? Is Adele here?
Can you change it to Delhi?
Delhi.
Delhi.
Del. Ed. Protected. There you are. Edie.
How do I protect the family from vicarious trauma?
How do you do that? And protect yourself and family from vicarious trauma. Do you ever go home freaked out, or have you in your career gone home a bit sort of grumpy and freaked out?
Grumpy, often.
Grumpy. Someone spills the milk and you go off tap and they go, Dad, what is with Dad?
I do remember yelling so loudly at one of my then youngish children, perhaps teenagers, so loudly that the neighbours heard me. Because they'd opened the door to a stranger. And there were two things here. One is, you know, bad guys. And the other one was getting served with summonses by process service who were wanting me to go to court and be sued.
Yeah.
And so I had my kids all lined up saying, no.
Never heard of
him. He's not here.
Yeah.
He's interstate. So, and they said, but anyway, but we just saw him walk outside. No, that was my brother. He's an old-looking brother. Anyway, I remember yelling at one of my kids because I was stressed out by the possibility that it was someone we didn't want to see, and I didn't want them opening the door and letting somebody, some clown in.
So the way to avoid that, I didn't really discuss a lot of this stuff with my family. I didn't really take my work home and talk to them about it much, particularly kids.
What about Mrs. Rule? Would you talk to her?
Inevitably with the big story like that, yes.
Molly Nina, Moll. Are you here, Moll?
Yep, up there.
Has there been any one crime or story that's really affected you that you haven't been able to stop thinking about?
I'm going to share this with you, and Emily's very big on this one. It's the Margaret Tapp case, Margaret and Shauna Tapp.
Yep.
Margaret was a mother in her late 30s. She had a 10-year-old daughter called Shauna. Their bodies were found. They'd been murdered back in the 1984, the year of the Los Angeles Olympics, wasn't it? It was during the Olympics.
Yep.
And this was out at their relatively humble house in a street in Ferntree Gully.
I can still picture myself driving to the airport one day, listening to your podcast about this, and there was a moment when I gasped out loud at a detail that you mentioned, and I went, that. It was amazing.
It's a terrible case because you've got a mother and a daughter who there's no killer ever been found.
Mm.
They've never looked like finding anyone. I think it fell through the cracks with the police for various reasons. One of them being that one of the police that went to that job used to carry a Big M carton with a straw in it, but it wasn't milk in the carton.
Mm-hmm.
This would be for breakfast.
Right.
And that doesn't help. There was also another major murder mystery out that way, which you're familiar with.
Yeah, Nanette Ellis.
Nanette Ellis, who used to work at Leader Newspapers.
She did. She was a newspaper manager.
And for various reasons, possibly one of them is that she was a very beautiful woman.
She was stunning.
Which leads to, it sort of warps things for the bad, wrong reasons. But that case sort of took the shine off the Tapp one somehow. And the Tapp one never really got past first base. And it's not really the police's fault. Normally those things they call for, they have big publicity drives, they have press conferences, but I believe that Margaret Tapp's own family were probably conservative, deeply shocked, probably religious people who had never agreed with Margaret's lifestyle, which was fairly racy, and didn't want to wear all her dirty linen in public, and probably didn't help the police much by projecting the way that the Ellis family did. And I think that sort of killed it stone dead. I also think that the only candidate I've come across for it who's good for it, maybe, was a medical person who was sort of above suspicion. And I think that the best candidate for it, according to his own children, is a person who was a doctor. Who wore volley sand shoes.
Yes, the volley sand shoes.
Because the only clue that they could never work out was why were there volley sand shoe prints in this house. They couldn't link them to anybody who knew her.
I always remember that from your big feature you did on the anniversary many years ago.
Yeah.
The son of a doctor contacted me indirectly and I spoke to him and his friends, and it does, the finger of suspicion does point at a certain doctor with whom Margaret Tapp was a nurse, and she was enormously charismatic and attractive and interesting, and doctors particularly really liked her, and she'd had affairs with seven of them. And this made it tricky for the police because, it's a hydra-headed monster, and she knew a lot of people and a lot of people knew her, and they just didn't know which thread to follow.
You can read Andrew Rule's columns in the Herald Sun and the Herald Sun online. And don't miss his podcast, Life and Crimes with Andrew Rule. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.